Good morning.
That's all. Okay. Good morning.
It's kind of a sleepy spring morning, isn't it? Therefore, the promise remains. Today, if you will hear my voice, do not harden your hearts. The promise of a rest. And we started talking about this rest last week, that's referred to in the beginning of Hebrews, Hebrews 2. Which is interesting because that's a book addressed to a very different audience than the one sitting around in the wilderness listening to Moses, and different again from the audience today, sitting around in a blossoming but dreary spring morning in a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and yet the promise and the invitation are the same. And it's interesting how so often warnings and invitations can go side by side, just as fear and love can be side by side. And sometimes our little brains have a hard time holding those together. The invitation to enter into God's rest. Now that sounds appealing. That sounds consoling. It sounds delightful. It sounds like a woo. And yet it comes side by side with a fire bursting out of the top of a mountain that's quaking with rocks running down it. And sometimes, as we saw in our readings last week, plagues that break out and kill over 1,000 people. And perhaps in today's world, warfare that breaks out or natural disasters. And we kind of go, how is that the one who warns, the one who commands, the one who sort of elicits fear, concurrent with this gentle, inviting, wooing voice that invites us into love? And what I'm sort of laying side by side is what we often, and I think rather mistakenly, divide as sort of the New Testament God and the Old Testament God. You know, we think of the God of Mount Sinai, the God who gives the Ten Commandments, as the scary one, the bad cop. And Jesus comes in the New Testament and teaches us a new way. And he's the warm and fuzzy that we can really get close to and be a friend with. And yet I understand why our minds do that, because we have a really hard time thinking of the two being one and the same. What struck me as I was sitting with Moses' words, and we'll backtrack a little bit into sort of the context in which these chapters are being given, but as I was meditating on them, they just started to sound so much to me and feel so much to me like Jesus' last words in the upper room with his disciples. And we've just walked through Holy Week and are in Easter. And when I sit in the upper room with Jesus and his disciples in John 13 to 17, as he's sort of summarizing all the things that he's been trying to communicate to them by doing them in their midst, teaching them in their midst, the wonders he has worked, the life he has lived in front of them and modeled. And now he's sort of at that last moment where he's tying it all together because he's not about to be with them anymore. And the things that Jesus says to his disciples in the last room, in the upper room, his last words, when I lay them out, and then I look at Moses' last words, which is what the book of Deuteronomy is, it's like, oh my goodness, they're saying kind of the same thing. And we'll circle back to that at the end, but it begins to bring the two together. So we'll sit with that and listen for it as we have this time together. It starts with Deuteronomy as a book, starts with kind of saying, these are Moses' last words. And so the question came up, who wrote Deuteronomy? And though Deuteronomy doesn't claim internally who wrote it, as some of the books of the Bible do, I think most scholars through history think that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. And so Deuteronomy is the final of those five words. And actually, if you track it, Deuteronomy, from beginning to end, is kind of all a direct quote of Moses. It's not describing any more story or any more narrative in real time. It's actually Moses recounting what's happened over the 40 plus years that they've been walking together. And if you remember from our from last week, as we were still in Numbers, Aaron died, Miriam dies. So this chapter of their life together is winding down, and Moses knows he's about to die. He also knows that the 40 years of wilderness wanderings are coming to an end, and he's kind of recounting, here's our history. Well, there's a lot at stake. This isn't just an old man kind of reviewing his life and wanting to get it into the autobiography to make sure it's preserved for a legacy. It's so much more than that. Moses has been leading a people that have become a nation. These are a people who are all descendants of the same man. These are the children of Israel, who was the grandson of Abraham. So they have this shared heritage, but we all know how extended families go. As it grows and branches out, there's less and less of a sense of connection. There's less and less that holds us together. And these people had been sort of a smaller family unit when they entered Egypt, and then they've been stable during their years in Egypt. They lived in the same place, on the same land, and they had massively multiplied. They'd gone from being sort of a family of about 70 to being a people of thousands by the time they leave Egypt. Egypt, in many ways, was the nursery for this nation, even though so much of their time in Egypt, their status was as slaves. It didn't slow down their reproduction and their growth. And by the time now they're about to enter the land, despite what they've been through, despite spending over 40 years as nomads in a land that was a desert, so they don't have farms, they don't have fields, they don't have ways of producing, they don't have homes, they're in a hostile territory where there's not a lot of food, they've continued to reproduce and to grow. And so they are now this mighty nation. We ended our last session with the census that God told Moses to take. And I forget how many, they're in the six digits of people. They're not quite a million, but that's still a lot of people who don't actually have a land or homes or institutions or a government. If you think about that many people living together, what is it that's going to hold them together as a people? They're too big to be held together by an identity as being a family. They don't all know each other. There's no way they will. And sometimes what holds people together is geographic, establishment. Well, we're in a city, we're in a neighborhood, we have schools, we have roads, we have a courthouse, we have a government, we have kind of systems that hold us together as a people. They don't have those either. So what has held them together, in Egypt was the shared threat, a shared enemy, the shared status as outsiders. What's held them together through the desert has been survival, but it's really been this one leader who has been the one on whom all their lives and their livelihood has hinged. They go where he goes because where he goes is where God is going, and that's where there's going to be manna. That's where there's going to be water, even if it has to come out of a rock. That's where there's going to be protection. So survival has held them together around this one leader. Now he's about to die. There's no constitution. There's no written contract. There's no physical stuff to hold this people from together. There's nothing to keep them from just sort of, well, see ya guys, it's been real, and drift off and kind of everybody make their way forward. What's going to forge an identity and a unity and even an organization for them? So that they don't descend into anarchy, chaos, or just scatter and disintegrate as a people. So Moses is retelling their story because their story is the thing that they have in common. Their story is the thing that they will continue
to share when he's no longer there as the integration point for them as a people. So he begins by saying, here, listen, remember. And these are the themes of sort of what went wrong for them, is that when they forgot the things that God had done, when they didn't wait for God's plans to unfold, this is when it goes poorly for them. And so Moses is sort of being a teacher of a nation, and he's the voice of wisdom. So he's rehearsing the events and doing so in a way that reminds them not just what they experienced firsthand, but also the meaning behind it. Remember when you yoked yourselves to the balls of Peor. Remember what happened when you allowed yourself to just kind of go with the flow of the gods and the practices of the people around you, which in some ways is a survival technique, you know, blend in or be killed. But remember what happened? Remember the plagues that broke out on you? Mm-hmm. Also remember what happened when people oppressed you. Remember what God did to them. So it's remember plagues when they were in your favor and not in your favor. And so Moses is calling them back into their firsthand experience, the things that they've witnessed, the things that their parents went through, as a way not just of teaching principles and laws and rules, but also of employing their logic, their senses, their memory, their experiences into this wisdom teaching. And what he's binding them to is God. That's going to be the central integrating point. They still don't have a government. There is no succession plan. I mean, the mantle will fall to Joshua, but not because Joshua is Moses' son. So there's not a dynasty going on here. And it's not because they held an election. So there's no democracy set up. Really, it's on whoever God, the Spirit of God, falls will be their appointed leader. And, you know, for those of you who are familiar with where the history is going to go, they'll have Moses, they'll have Joshua, and then they won't have anybody, and they will descend into chaos, and then things will go really bad for them because they will stop keeping the commands of God because they won't have anybody to remind them and hold them to it, and then they will be oppressed, and everything, basically everything that Moses is warning about will happen to them again and again and again. And Moses actually finishes the book of Deuteronomy by saying, this is going to happen to you on repeat. You will forget, just as you already have, even when you still had me right here. You're going to forget. You're going to go after these other gods. You're going to stop keeping the commands of God. You're going to stop remembering to worship him and worship him only. And then bad things will happen to you like they've already done. And then you'll cry out from your captivity, from being scattered. And God, who will still remember you and be compassionate, will restore you and bring you back. So I'm just telling you in advance, this is kind of how it's already been going, and it's going to keep going. But I'm trying to help you here so that it doesn't have to be as bad as it will be if you don't pay attention. So in many ways, Moses is drawing them into a shared practice of keeping these traditions, of keeping the law that God's given, and a shared identity of who are we? What is it that makes us an us? It's not a geographic region because we don't have one. We're not even in the land yet. It's not a set of documents that our founding fathers put together that we can now return to. In fact, Moses is probably the first person to write any of the scriptures. So that's even new. It's not like they've had the word to go back to and to kind of keep them on course. That's part of what he's giving them is the word. The first written word really are the Ten Commandments, and he reminds them, these tablets of stone, this is kind of the external objective thing that you have to keep. Now, if we think about nationhood and history, one of the great marks of a civilization and greatest gifts that people could have would be a good law. And if you think of back to the Code of Hammurabi and other kind of breakthrough moments in ancient history, when someone was able to come up with a code that everyone was subject to. Now for us, we're kind of used to thinking that this is normal and this is just how civilizations work. But if you go to the ancient world, that really what held a nation together was a tyrant or a king, you know, as benevolent as they may be, it was somebody who said, my word is the rule. And how radical it was to have a law that stood the test of time, that was encoded for everyone to be able to refer to, and that everyone was subject to, including the leaders. This is kind of radical. And yet this is exactly what God had given them, was a law. And not too different from some of the most brilliant laws first given, much of the Ten Commandments, which we looked at, are kind of the kind of laws that are given in good and just societies, that life is sacred, you can't take someone else's life, that property and the ownership of property, therefore it is honored, therefore you can't take what belongs to someone else, that are speaking the truth, particularly testimony in a court of law, of bearing witness about someone else, is important because this is part of preserving the rights and the dignity of each person. And so don't bear false witness against your neighbor. And interestingly, the honoring of parents is something that shows up in almost all ancient codes and laws. And is highly emphasized. And that's interesting to me as sort of in our modernist world, you tend to think of family structures being enforced by a legal national code. And yet there's always been that sort of understanding, but at least honoring parents, how that gets interpreted and everything. Because this isn't just talking about when in the state of being a child. It's a lifelong honoring of parents. But with all of these, honoring parents, murder, theft, adultery, which is very interesting, sexuality, but particularly within the covenant or the contract of marriage, is to be honored. These are the things that make it into this code that certainly isn't the full extent of the Mosaic Law, because we've been reading, there's a lot of other things that have been set up of how they were to live that got a lot more specific and a lot more into the nitty-gritty. But this at the core of it is teaching people how to live in right relationship with each other. Prior to them though, and after them, and really so much of what Moses keeps calling on is how to live in right relationship with God. And of course he's gonna summarize it in chapter 6, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And that kind of really is the perfect summary of all the law and the prophets, which is what Jesus is going to quote when a young lawyer asks him the same question a long time later. The keeping of this law is the difference between order and chaos, justice and peace versus dictatorship and anarchy, prosperity versus violence and unrest. And so just on a very surface level, there's nothing magical about this law. It's like God saying, guess what? I know humanity. I know how you work. I want things to go well for you. So I'm just going to give it to you up front. Keep this and life will be good. Life will be nice together. And that's not all it is. But I think so often we sort of mystify the Ten Commandments and fail to just recognize the basic civic brilliance of this gift that God was giving to his people. But it's so much more than simply a code that mediates human relationships. Behind all of it is this call to love. And in that, what we hear is not just a code of conduct that's external, but all the way back in this giving of law, in this rehearsing of who they are, and this rehearsing of their story, and this calling them to a way of life, Moses is calling the people into a living relationship. Because love is not just a code of conduct. Love is, first and foremost, a relationship. And they've had a really tricky time of this, and he recounts this to them also in Deuteronomy 4-6. He recounts what it was like when they went to Mount Horeb, which is also Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. And this was not Moses' first time at that mountain. And it wasn't Moses' first time running into a fire on that mountain. That's the mountain where he ran into the burning bush. And if you remember with that story, the first time he ran into the burning bush, he knew this is God of some sort, but he didn't know, who are you? You remember he asked, who are you? And God identifies himself. I am who I am. I'm the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I'm the God that your parents told you about, just as now God, Moses is saying, keep telling your kids. How did Moses know who that was? Because there had been a faithful transmission of his ancestors telling their stories of their encounters, their experiences, and the promises and instructions they'd received from this same God. But God also says, I'm me. Mm-hmm. And I love it when God introduces himself. He does so by introducing himself as a personal being. Mm-hmm. I'm not just a force. Now, you're experiencing me as a fire, as an earthquake. Last week, we talked about God being the rock that was with them all through the wilderness. And the rock that Moses unthinkingly struck and abused, in a sense, as God being present in so many different forms that they didn't recognize. Moses talks to them and says, no nation has ever seen God. And it's a radical thing that this God, who is both so unseeable and in a way unknowable, so mysterious, the one who created the heavens and the earth, has chosen to, in a way, confine himself to particular forms so that you could see him by seeing that fire, that you could hear him and hear his voice. And even when you haven't seen and heard him, you've seen and heard the things that he's done. You've been eyewitnesses of these things. Think of Jesus saying to the disciples, you are witnesses of these things. And it's your job now to go into all the nations and testify of what you've seen and heard. And in a way, that's exactly what Moses is commissioning the people to do. Go and tell your children. And in the rehearsing of this, your own faith will be strengthened. It will become more and more the story that you are consciously living in, but it'll also be passed on to those who wouldn't know if you didn't tell it. In inviting them then to hear, and the notes sort of talked about the Shema, the hear. There's so many layers of what Moses he's discipling the nation. Mm-hmm. He's calling them to be disciples and to make disciples. And he's saying, consider, meditate, chew on what I'm telling you, what you've seen, what you've heard about. Chew on it until it's the reality that you're still conscious of when you do have a house to live in, when you do have fields to farm, when you do have neighbors who are encroaching on you and you're scared and you're tempted to handle it and not in the ways that God has called you to. He's also saying, pay attention, because this is so important that if it doesn't lodge in you, it won't. It's easily lost. We know that. This is your humanity. And he's also saying here, as in obey, listen, because listen as if these are the instructions that you're going to base the rest of your life on. Behind all of this, though, Moses is inviting the people into the kind of direct relationship that he has been sharing with God. When he first met God, God introduced himself. God introduced himself not just as that one who your ancestors knew, but I'm me, and I'd like you to know me. So there's this invitation into a personal relationship that God had extended to Moses first time around. But if you remember, it also came with a warning. Take your shoes off. This is holy ground. I'm not someone to be trifled with. And I sense that this is, I don't understand why, but this is one of our struggles as humans. We know how to fear and revere. And we know how to be intimate, but in so doing, often a bit dismissive. I think of actually, and this is maybe revealing more of myself than I really want to, but when I first met the man I would marry, there was distance And I saw him as someone that I really admired and respected. I saw the things that he did. He was wise, he was strong, he was a leader. I saw how other people responded to him. And I deeply respected him. And his opinion meant so much. Mm-hmm. He became the man I so share my life with that he's almost like an extension of me. And then when he would say something like, "You are so beautiful," I thought, "You are so delusional." Because intimacy often engenders disregard, which is strange. You would think we would be able to maintain intimacy and a sense of someone's otherness, their holy otherness. But we have a hard time with that. And I think this is one of the dynamics we see all through Scripture with humans in relating with God. When Moses brought the children of Israel to Mount Sinai, and he rehearses this to them, "Do you remember when I took you there and there was the fire coming out of the top and God was talking? You said, you go talk to him and let us know and we'll do whatever he says." Basically, the people had requested a mediated relationship because the fear and the reverence of this all-consuming fire, this jealous God, which he really is, was so overwhelming to them that they themselves requested distance. They wanted a mediator. They didn't want to encounter that because it was dangerous. And it is. Being in a relationship with all-consuming fire is dangerous. He's not a tame lion, to refer to Aslan. And yet Moses had gone up into the mountain. Moses had experienced being shaken. He had experienced being taken beyond the limits of his frail frame, and had come to see God face to face and had become a friend of God. And yet, even as a friend of God, there were times that God was mysterious to him and even frustrating to him. And even as a friend of God, and maybe it was that sort of intimacy that made him feel like he could just hit the rock. It's that forgetting a little bit that God is both all-consuming fire and that dear whisper. By the way, when Elijah encountered the earthquake, the fire, and eventually the whisper, you do realize where he was on the same mountain. It's not Nebo. Oh, it's not Horeb, which is Nebo. Also Sinai. Well, Nebo is where Moses dies at the end. That's a different. But this mountain of encounter in the Old Testament is a place that the people of God keep going back to, yeah. And it's interesting because the author of Hebrews contrasts that mountain with the mountain that we are invited to. And he shows that it is terrifying, but it's lost its terror because the one who loves us is wooing us to come into it. And as Moses kind of gives his parting commands, yes, he refers to these tablets of stone on which the law has been written and says, "Keep this and it'll go well with you. But guess what? Your hearts aren't going to be able to handle this. They're going to stray." Which is exactly what God said. "These people don't know me. Their hearts go astray. I will give them new hearts and I will write my law on those hearts." The difference is not that God changes from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Mm-hmm. He's always been all-consuming fire, and he's also always been Yahweh, gracious, compassionate, abounding in love. This is how he introduces himself, and this is what Moses reminds them of. This is what he is. He's both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And if you can hold on to that and are willing to be consumed by the all-consuming fire, you'll find that it doesn't consume. It refines and it purifies and it transforms. That was Moses' experience. It's not yet the experience that the people had embraced. They wanted to be in covenant relationship, but they wanted it to be mediated through Moses. And now Moses is not going to be there anymore. And in many ways, Moses is calling them to something he knows they can't yet do. God had given them the gift of his self-revelation. And he had also insisted on his own personhood when they would forget it, denigrate it, and walk away. And what God was really calling them into was to giving him his heart and inviting him into their hearts, where he would direct their actions from within and even give them the capacity to love the way he already loved them. The tablets of stone, that rock in the wilderness, would eventually inhabit their own hearts as the person of the Holy Spirit. When God gives the command, love me, love the Lord your God, it's as much a plea as it is a command. Oh, that my people would love me. And he understands that love ultimately can't be commanded. Mm-hmm. Obedience can be. Love is something that's all of me. I can go through the motions and do the right thing. But to love is to give myself. And God is inviting, wooing his people. Oh, that my people would give themselves to me the way I already give myself to them. And he's done that. He's given himself to them. He's been in their midst. And he's already demonstrated with the serpent on the stick the way he's going to give himself to them in the flesh. Mm-hmm. He's given them his heart. He's given them the ability to make him mad, which you only get mad at someone you care about. He's given them the ability to make him sad, and he's given them the ability to bring him joy. He has already entered into relationship with them. And he's watching as they waver in their commitment and ability and even affection towards him. When Jesus comes to rescue us from slavery, from our inability to remember, to obey, to love, he summarizes the law and the prophets as a call, a command to love. And when he stands in the upper room that last night, doing for his disciples what Moses was doing for the people, he says to them, a new command I give you. Mm-hmm. Love one another. And it's so funny because you think, Jesus, what commands have you given in your lifetime of living in our midst? Mm-hmm. What rules did you give? If anything, you were constantly sort of debunking this rigid legalism. And yet he talks about a command. And is it actually a new command? Or is it not the command that had been given all along? Love me. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you'll do this, we don't need anything else, because you will fulfill all these other rules that are put down in code on stone and some. You will honor your neighbor. You will honor your marriage contracts. You will honor your neighbor's possessions, your neighbor's life. In fact, you'll give yourself for them rather than seek to take from them. And this will become the center point that holds together a new people, which is exactly what Jesus was doing. He was inaugurating a new nation, a new people, that would be held together not by geography, not by institution, not by contract or law or by a government, but would be held together by the one who wrote the tablets of stone, inhabiting each of their hearts and producing this kind of love. And that's exactly what Jesus said as he was preparing to leave. Remain in me and I in you. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Jesus recognized that his disciples would fail at this, that they would scatter. In fact, he said that, just as Moses said it. You're not gonna remember this. You're gonna strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. And then he says, but after that, when you remember, turn back and encourage your brothers. And in a way, it's almost making provision for their humanity. And what Jesus was going to give is something that Moses could not yet give. And that is not just a code, not just a way of being together, not just teaching to remember, but the power of the Holy Spirit who would dwell within instead of stone, flesh, to give them this capacity to love. And what he said about the Spirit was that he would remind them. Moses says, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget. Jesus said, I'll send one who will remind you of my teachings. Moses said probably like 20 times in the first few chapters of Deuteronomy, don't be afraid, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. What does Jesus say again and again in the upper room? Let not your hearts be troubled. Don't be afraid, don't be anxious. Why? Because I'm still going to be with you. Even though you won't see me, I will still be present with you. He says, I will send that helper to comfort you, to guide you, to embolden you in your identity as children of God, even when you can no longer see God, and to produce the love in you that will bind you both to God and to each other, the same love that fulfills the law. And so the Spirit holds us in God's love. The Spirit incarnates God's love in us, in the same way that Jesus was God incarnate in the midst of the disciples, and in a way in which Moses, the friend of God, was God's representative in the midst of the children of Israel. And that really is, I think, where I like to land, is pulling together the God who's always been the same. And in a sense, we frail humans who've always been the same, and yet the difference between the two is the Spirit, who has the ability to hold us in honoring and respecting the mystery, the personhood of God, who is wholly other, but who is also fully intimate, fully within, fully with, and who binds us together.
Catherine, do you have any announcements?
I have
an announcement.
Oh, yes.
I have now up to three glasses.
Three pairs of glasses.
They're so similar. They almost look like they're the same.
And if they aren't all claimed today, I'd like to borrow one for a small group.